From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, veteran war surgeon Dr. Chris Yanu. He's the head surgeon with the International Committee of the Red Cross. He was in Afghanistan from mid-November through the end of the year, traveling with a Red Cross convoy, making the rounds of hospitals and prisons, evaluating medical needs, training physicians, and performing surgery as needed. Also, we meet Father Chris Keenan, a Catholic chaplain of the Fire Department of New York. He replaced Father Michael Judge, who was killed on September 11th while praying over dying firefighters at the World Trade Center. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Federal prosecutors have charged a retired Air Force sergeant with offering military secrets to Iraq, Libya, and China. Brian Regan was already in jail on an attempted espionage charge, but the latest indictment adds four more counts. Regan worked for the National Reconnaissance Office, an agency that builds and operates spy satellites for the U.S. military. Prosecutors charged that he sent a letter to Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, saying that he would provide highly classified information for $13 million. President Bush has announced a new climate plan that would allow carbon dioxide emissions to continue to increase for at least a decade. He said cutting carbon dioxide would harm the U.S. economy. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The new climate policy bases carbon dioxide emissions on economic growth. President Bush's plan calls for emissions to grow more slowly than the economy, but to grow nonetheless. Measures to slow the growth would be voluntary, including incentives to businesses, farmers, and consumers. In a speech, the president said he still stands by the principle that human beings should avoid making dangerous changes to the atmosphere, but he didn't lay out a long-term plan to accomplish that goal. Critics say the plan represents only a small change from business as usual, and they say it lacks the powerful incentives that are needed to shift the world economy away from oil and coal-based technologies, which contribute most to climate change. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
The Israeli army says three Israelis were killed and two wounded in an attack on an Israeli convoy passing through Gaza today. The army says Palestinians ambushed a civilian convoy guarded by soldiers, setting off a bomb under an Israeli tank. Yemen has confirmed that a man killed in a police raid was related to one of the 19 suspected hijackers involved in the September 11th attacks. NPR's Kate Seeley has more from Beirut.
According to Yemeni officials, an al-Qaeda suspect who died yesterday was the brother-in-law of Khalid al-Mehdar. Mehdar is believed to be among the hijackers who boarded the plane that crashed into the Pentagon. 25-year-old Samir Mohammed al-Hada was killed when the hand grenade he intended to throw at police exploded in his hand. Officials say he'd been under surveillance in Yemen's capital Sana'a for more than a week when he tried to flee police and a gun battle ensued. Yemen's defense ministry said today that Hada had received advanced military training in Afghanistan, where his brother, an explosives expert, was killed. According to U.S. officials, Hada was also related to a Yemeni named in an FBI alert issued on Monday. The U.S. had warned of a possible terrorist attack on Yemen or the United States. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 11 points to close at 10,001 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 15 to close at 1843. This is NPR News. A jury in Phoenix, Arizona, has convicted a man from Saudi Arabia of lying to the FBI about his connection to one of the September 11th hijackers. Faisal Al-Salmi was not charged with terrorism, but with telling FBI agents that he didn't know Hani Hanjour, one of the men who seized the plane that smashed into the Pentagon. Prosecutors say the two men were registered at the same time to use a flight simulator at a school for pilots in Phoenix. FBI agents testify that Al-Salmi changed his story a number of times during interviews. Sentencing is scheduled for the end of April. A small fire broke out today near the U.S. base in Kandahar, Afghanistan. It was inadvertently set off by U.S. troops on alert for more attacks, like the one yesterday that injured two Americans. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
The fire was set off by illumination flares set up by U.S. troops trying to get a better look at the area. Yesterday, the base at Kandahar came under fire from unknown attackers. U.S. troops of the 101st Airborne returned fire and sent Apache helicopters to the area, but the attackers were not found. Seven men detained at the site turned out to be part of an Afghan security force that helps protect the base. Two soldiers who received minor wounds were both treated and back on duty today. According to a CENTCOM spokesman, troops sent up flares today again to illuminate the area as a precaution aimed at avoiding any further attack. Due to the dry conditions, an area near the base caught fire before being extinguished. The base at Kandahar houses more than 4,100 troops and al-Qaeda and Taliban prisoners. Greg Allen, NPR News, Washington.
General Motors announced today it plans to lay off 1,100 workers at its Linden, New Jersey plant and up to 1,750 in Orion Township, Michigan. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Big Chalk, providing teachers, students, and parents with online educational resources for research, classroom instruction, and homework help on the web at bigchalk.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Dr. Chris Yanu, a veteran war surgeon who is now the head surgeon with the International Committee of the Red Cross. He was in Afghanistan with the Red Cross, making the rounds of hospitals and prisons from mid-November through the end of the year. Some of the hospitals he worked in were located in areas controlled by the Taliban, others by the Northern Alliance. The Red Cross convoy he traveled with made its way across landmine fields and flooded rivers. The mission was to deliver medical supplies, evaluate the medical needs at hospitals, train doctors and surgeons, and perform surgery as needed. Dr. Yanu has worked as a war surgeon in Lebanon, Somalia, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and many other places. I asked him to describe one of the typical hospitals he saw in Afghanistan.
Well, how typical is any hospital in Afghanistan? Let me give you an example of the Kunduz Hospital, which went through a very, very difficult situation. This is in a large compound, and everything is one floor. There's no second story. Most of the third world, you do not use elevators. So hospitals are a modular system, several buildings, all ground floor. And this is a large brick and stone structure that was built about 25, 30 years ago. Very high ceilings. The Kunduz Hospital is large. It's about 200, 250 beds. And the hospital had functioned very, very well. Even under the Taliban regime, the hospital staff had been there. They were staying. When the Taliban retreated, and before Northern Alliance troops could enter the city of Kunduz, there was a gap of about six or eight hours. And during that period, there was looting in the hospital. Again, uncontrolled soldiers went in. They took whatever medicines and easy-to-carry equipment that they could, and they threatened the staff. And several days earlier, I had been told that one of the doctors, a dentist, had been shot dead by some of these uncontrolled elements. The staff was truly shocked, and although the Northern Alliance now controlled Kunduz, it was quiet, they still refused to go back to the hospital. So the hospital was quite empty. There were only about 10 or 12 nurses, one or two doctors.
They refused to go back because they were afraid?
They were afraid. They were afraid that security was still not guaranteed, that there would still be further looting. We delivered medicines. The director of the hospital said, please don't leave the medicines. If you leave the medicines, then this will be a target for more looting. So we left the medicines in the office of the governor of Kunduz. We saw the governor, we tried to see the military authorities, and over the next 2 or 3 days, we insisted on seeing the military authorities of the Northern Alliance to get them to assure the security of the hospital. And I was away in Talokan, which is only about an hour and a half from Kunduz. You have to drive through a minefield. And 2 or 3 days later, when I then returned, I found the hospital full of staff, and they were cleaning up and starting to operate again. During that first week, we had to evacuate about 10, 12 patients from Kunduz to the still-functioning hospital in Talokan. These were wounded patients, mostly, a couple of ill. The hospital staff was back, and when I asked, they said, now the security is all right. We are assured there is no further looting. We have our system back in place to assure our security and that of the patients. And the hospital started functioning again.
I know you performed some surgery during your rounds of the hospitals in Afghanistan. You were there to evaluate their needs, but you also performed some surgery as well. How did you decide whether you should step in or not?
Well, many of the surgeons I had worked with previously, and therefore they knew me. And there was not a question of my stepping in. It was usually a question of my Afghan colleagues asking me, please, we have this sort of case. Would you please come and do the case with us? And this occurred for a couple of bone cases, orthopedics. One case where there was an injury of an artery in a vein, and it forms a fistula between the artery and the vein. And these are a little bit more specific types of operations. Where they said, we've been trying these things before, but would you please come and work with us? So those are the sort of cases. It was not a question of my stepping in. It was really a question of my colleagues saying, please come and do this with us.
Could you describe one of those surgeries and why it was so difficult for the doctors there to perform it?
Well, vascular surgery is a particular specialization. And there's a big difference between a relatively healthy artery, such as the femoral in the thigh, that you may cut or a butcher may cut with a knife, and you get a nice clean cut. And it's very easy to find the artery, and it's very easy to patch it together again. When you get a bullet wound, and all of the muscles around it are damaged as well, it's sometimes difficult to even find the artery. And a segment of it may be injured, and therefore you have to dissect it off, which means now the artery is short, and you have to be able to mobilize it for several inches upstream and down in order to then get the two ends together so that you can do your suture, your anastomosis. And when you get a very small injury in both the artery and in the vein, there is a passage of blood that goes between the two. And some of the blood clots, and it gets larger and larger and larger, and then starts pulsating. And it can very easily infect, and when it does sort of rupture, the patient very easily bleeds to death, or you grab a hold of the artery, and then you're usually faced with an amputation. And trying to dissect through this fragile tissue that has been damaged by the bullet, by the shrapnel fragment, can be difficult. These were the cases that my colleagues asked me to help them with.
Was this particular surgery successful?
It was, yes.
Did you have anesthesia
not always the
for
case,
the patient?
But it was. Pardon?
Did you have anesthesia for the
yes,
patient?
Oh yes. Oh yes. We supplied the hospitals. They did not run short of anything.
And there was antibiotics to prevent infection afterwards?
Yes. The best antibiotic is good surgery.
What were the conditions you had to perform the surgery under?
The operating theater is cold. They do not have central heating, and in northern Afghanistan especially, it reaches zero and below zero. To heat the operating theater, they use a wooden stove called a bukhari. Some work with diesel fuel, others with wood, and you have to stoke it. It sometimes gets a bit smoky. But that is the only way to heat the operating theater and the wards.
Well, what about the smoke and the soot? Does that infect the wound?
You try to keep the soot away, but the body also has its mechanisms of defense.
And if your fingers get cold, it's not a good thing if you're performing
exactly.
Surgery.
That's why they try to heat the room.
Right. Did the hospital?
It's also good for the patient. I mean, a patient who has been bleeding and is in shock goes into hyperthermia. And that hypothermia will then create problems for blood coagulation. And therefore, you have to keep the room warm, not just for the surgeon's benefit, but also for the patient's benefit.
What was your impressions of how Taliban control had affected the medical system in terms of women, women doctors, women patients?
Well, a great deal has been said about this in the Western press, and a great deal of it is wrong. What is true is that from 1996 on, the health system, what was left of it, truly fell apart. And what remained was the parallel system that the ICRC, the World Health Organization, NGOs set up. We were the ones who were running the health system, certainly not the Taliban regime. The question of stopping women of going to certain hospitals, etc., that only concerned Kabul. In Kandahar, which was the capital of the Taliban, the one central hospital, and that's all there was for about 2-3 million people in several provinces, well, there was the women's ward and there was the men's ward. And you had women nurses and doctors taking care of the women and men doctors and nurses taking care of the men. And one little event that occurred just over a year ago was that in Kandahar, and they did not consult us. The Taliban authorities took the initiative themselves to open up a school of nursing. They had 200 students, 100 men and 100 women. So there was the Taliban School of Nursing training women to be nurses so that there would be female nurses to take care of female patients. Now, that's not to say that, obviously, the Taliban truly considered the status of women. Women were still refused the possibility to work apart from the health professions. And it's very difficult to train somebody to be a nurse if they are totally illiterate. But the Taliban were full of such contradictions. They wanted their own wives and sisters to be treated by female medical staff. And then they thought, well, how are we going to have female medical staff if we don't train the women? So let's train the female nurses. But before that, you've got to teach them how to read and write. But they'd closed down the schools. So they were caught up in their own contradictions, of their own worldview of things. But that's not the least of their shortcomings. But women did, to a certain extent, have access to certain things. What people must also understand is that Afghanistan is a very conservative, traditional society. Today, the Taliban are gone. 0.5% of women in the country have taken off the burqa. 99.5% of women continue to wear the burqa, and it has absolutely nothing to do with the Taliban. It has everything to do with a patriarchal, socially conservative society. And it's going to take quite some time for people to even get back to the days of the old communist regime where you saw miniskirts in Kabul.
Did you treat any women when you were in Afghanistan?
Yes.
And were they particularly uncomfortable being treated by a male doctor?
Not the ones that I did, but that has been known to occur. And one of the biggest problems is simply getting the woman to the hospital.
Why is that so difficult?
For these conservative villagers to accept that a woman should have access to medical care. Once she gets to the hospital, then there is care for her. But if you take a look at the hospital beds, 3/4 will be for men and only 1/4 for women. Most of the women who need medical care don't even get to the hospital. That's the problem. And that is a problem of a socially conservative society, which does not really care much for the state and status of women. But that predates the Taliban, and it continues to exist today. And so that is a totally different societal problem that Afghan society has to deal with, irrespective of who is in power.
Are there any changes in how the government is dealing with health now in Afghanistan?
In Afghanistan today, in the interim government, the new Minister of Health is a woman doctor, a female surgeon by the name of Soheila Sadiq. And Soheila, for me, epitomizes the contradictions in Afghan society. She was a former member of the Central Committee of the Afghan Democratic Communist Party. She was head surgeon of the military hospital. When there were Soviet surgeons there, she used to tell the Soviets what to do. She ordered them around. When the Mujahideen took over, this woman had such a reputation for honesty and integrity that they kept her as the head surgeon of the military hospital and the armed forces of Afghanistan. It was only the Taliban in 1996 who removed her as head surgeon. She resisted, and what she did was she took over a building within the compound of the military hospital in Kabul and set up a hospital for women and children. We provided her with instruments and medicines. She continued to work. Soheila is today the new Minister of Health. So here is an example of some of the contradictions of Afghan society, where many women do not have access to health care because their men folk simply do not bring them to a hospital. And at the same time, you have a woman who was chief surgeon of the Afghan armed forces, and she today is the Minister of Health.
My guest is Dr. Chris Yanu, head surgeon with the International Committee of the Red Cross. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Chris Yanu. He's the head surgeon for the International Committee of the Red Cross. In the past couple of years, he's been in Nepal, Sri Lanka, Chad, Macedonia, the Congo, Somalia, Sierra Leone, Uganda. From mid-November through the end of 2001, he was in Afghanistan, and we're talking about what he found there. During your travels through Afghanistan, you not only visited several hospitals, you visited several prisons to evaluate the medical needs of prisoners, and I imagine you performed some surgery there as well. Would you describe one of the prisons that you visited?
Well, most people, when they read in the papers that the Red Cross is visiting prisoners, they're rather surprised because they don't understand what's going on. A lot of our work is driven not by needs, assistance. It is driven by what we call protection issues. And this is the difference between human rights law and international humanitarian law, which is the law of war. In human rights law, what counts is the individual. And individuals, whether peacetime or wartime, have what are considered to be inalienable rights. The laws of war, humanitarian law, deal with categories of people. You have the civilian population as a category. You have prisoners of war or the wounded amongst military forces as categories of people who are protected. A prisoner is somebody who, in a war setting, has decided not to fight until death, not to lay down his arms and go home, but surrenders. And by surrendering, takes it upon himself a little bit like a soldier's honor to say, I no longer am a combatant. And at that point, you make him prisoner. And it's a sort of social contract. You're not supposed to execute him summarily. You're not supposed to torture him. You're supposed to detain him under what are considered to be humane conditions of detention. And the International Committee of the Red Cross, as one of the guarantors of the Geneva Conventions and their additional protocols, that is to say, the rules of war, we visit the prisons. Now, our prison visits include a delegate plus a health delegate, and we look at the conditions of detention.
So when you visited prisons and assessed the conditions there, did you see prisoners who seemed to have been victims of torture? Were there a lot of medical problems that you saw? Give us a sense of that.
There were a few medical problems. Some of the prisoners had been wounded. They had been treated. They needed further operations. And we organized with the hospital that occur. Now, apart from that, I cannot tell you what I see in a prison. This is supposed to be confidential, and it is a report that the ICRC makes to the detaining authorities. So we are visiting prisoners today, for instance, in Guantanamo Bay. What we see, what recommendations we make to the detaining authorities, in this case the United States, will remain confidential. They will be given only to American authorities of detention, and we will tell them that either everything is fine or that, no, this needs to be improved, that, etc., etc., but that will remain entirely confidential.
Have you personally been in the camp with the detainees in Guantanamo Bay?
No, I personally have not in Guantanamo Bay.
Okay. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Chris Yanu. He's the head surgeon with the International Committee of the Red Cross. When I interview a Western woman who has worked in Afghanistan, I always ask her about how she dresses and how she feels she needs to change her behavior in order to work there and be accepted by the people that she's working with. What about you as a Western man? Is there anything you have to take into account when you're working in Afghanistan with the Red Cross in terms of your dress, your behavior, the visual cues that you give off to whoever you're talking with? I don't know, anything that you have to.
Of course, you always have to be culturally sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
You are going into a society, a culture that is not yours. And there are certain things that are simply not well seen in that particular culture or society. and therefore you have to take that into consideration. You wear long sleeves shirts. You don't go around with your chest naked. There are various other things in your expressions and so forth. You learn this. At the same time, you then, as you get to know the society better, you get in with people. I mean, I go into hospitals and I go into the women's sections and I make jokes, and people accept it, and they know, and it's not considered bad form. But you have to know when to do it and how. In the city of Mazar-e Sharif, back in 98, I was there during Ramadan. Okay, this is before the Taliban took over. Now, Ramadan is the month where Muslims fast from sunrise to sunset. And I would be invited at noon by four generals of the security services of the four Mujahideen faction. And we would sit down and eat at noon and drink locally made vodka. And that is in Afghanistan, a socially conservative society. But that also exists. And like an Afghan would know, when do you do this and drink vodka at noon during Ramadan, and when do you not do it?
When is it okay to do it?
When everybody else around you is doing it as well.
That's a good answer.
I was back in Mazar-e Sharif this last year and so forth, and they were back after the Taliban. They were back to making their locally made vodka. At the Faculty of Medicine in Mazar-e Sharif, you have women students. They go around without a burqa, but only in the medical faculty. You do not make jokes with women out in the streets or this, that, or in certain homes. But in other homes you would, in the hospital you would. And this is simply getting to know the society and to respect the norms of that society and what is allowed, what is not allowed. And that's the case for a man, it's the case for a woman. And those are some of the constraints that you have in Afghanistan, but you have other sorts of constraints elsewhere.
What are some of what's a joke that's an appropriate joke to tell to women in a hospital in Afghanistan?
Let's see. You're smiling radiantly today. Is it because you got married or got divorced?
Is there such a thing as divorce there, though?
Oh, yes.
Yeah?
Oh, yes.
And does that usually get a laugh?
Well, it depends on the circumstances, of course.
Dr. Chris Yanu is head surgeon with the International Committee of the Red Cross. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Mary and O'Neill, a novel and stories by Justin Cronin, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Father Chris Keenan, Catholic chaplain of the Fire Department of New York. He replaced Father Michael Judge, who was killed on September 11th at the World Trade Center, where he was praying over dying firefighters. Also, we continue our conversation with war surgeon Dr. Chris Yanu.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Chris Yanu, head surgeon with the International Committee of the Red Cross. He spent the last 6 weeks of 2001 in Afghanistan with a Red Cross convoy, making the rounds of hospitals and prisons. Dr. Yanu has worked as a war surgeon in Lebanon, Somalia, Sierra Leone, Rwanda, and many other places. But one of the issues that you're particularly concerned about is landmines. And Afghanistan, before the war on terrorism, was already near the top of the list of countries with the most landmines. How has the war added to the problem?
Well, first of all, top of the list, not a question of how many landmines. That, in many respects, is irrelevant, although Afghanistan is one of the most mined countries in the world. The problem is what percentage of land that is economically productive or potentially productive and is excluded from the normal production circuit because of the presence of landmines. Now, sometimes you also find landmines in cities. A good deal of Kabul is still mined. You also have a problem of unexploded ordnance. And for populations, there's not much difference between a bomb that does not explode and a landmine. Both then stay in the ground, and if you walk on them, if you have a vehicle go over them, they explode. Some of them act as sort of booby traps, quite simply because of the way that they have fallen or been placed. And Afghanistan is probably the most affected country in terms of killed and wounded from landmines, anti-personnel, anti-vehicle, as well as unexploded ordnance. Now, the most recent fighting has simply resulted in large areas being remined. The front lines between Taliban forces and the United Front Northern Alliance were mined. The large minefields set out in defensive positions. They were not very useful, which is something we've been trying to tell people for very many years, not in terms of the actual outcome of the fighting. And then, of course, with that fighting, there's quite a lot of ordnance that was shot and simply did not explode when it hit the ground. And that is a particular concern when it comes to cluster bombs.
What are the problems that the cluster bombs pose?
Cluster bombs, let me describe them first of all. They're like a large canister. It can be shot from an airplane or from a piece of artillery. It opens up in midair, and it scatters anywhere from 200 to 600 little bomblets. Now, the numbers differ according to the particular type of cluster bomb being used. And these bomblets are scattered over a radius of 100 yards, 200 yards. And they're supposed to explode when they hit the ground. Anywhere from 5 to 30% do not explode when they hit the ground. And they sit on the ground, some of them very, very fragile. Often it's simply a question of walking next to them. You don't even have to touch the little bomblet for it to explode. And they sit there in the earth and act exactly like anti-personnel landmines at that point.
Did you see a lot of cluster bomb and landmine wounds in Afghanistan during this trip?
I was in the area of Talarkhan Kunduz to begin with, and this is up in the north. And the Taliban forces had been cut off in the Kunduz pocket and were besieged there for quite a while. And therefore, the front lines were around the city in between Talarkhan and Kunduz. And some of those front lines had been bombed by American aviation. Cluster bombs had been used. And in the succeeding weeks, we saw in the hospital, especially in Talarkhan, quite a number of people. And it varied. Three or four a day for several days, and then none, and then you would get six or seven. And people talked about landmines and cluster bombs. And this went on for quite some time. It's still going on. Now, again, even Afghan peasants are not stupid. And therefore, once you have several injuries or deaths in a particular area, the word gets around. People simply do not return there. And therefore, the number of victims may drop. As displaced persons return to their villages, the numbers of killed and wounded go back up again until people sort of sort out where they can go safely and where they cannot.
One of the things you had to do in getting to hospitals and prison camps in Afghanistan was to drive through minefields. Now, as a doctor, you're as aware as anyone is of the dangers of minefields and the horrible wounds that they inflict, not to mention death. So what's it like for you with all this knowledge to knowingly drive through a minefield so that you can get to treat mine victims at the other end?
You're scared. And you have to be stupid not to be scared. You don't just drive through a minefield. Usually what has happened is forces have advanced. They have cleared a breach in the minefield, which is so many yards wide, usually wide enough for one car, maybe two. And they'll then go back to try to clear up the rest of the mines, but they want to advance quickly. So they clear a road through. It usually works, at least for that small segment, although there was an example in the central mountainous region of Bamyan where we and a number of other organizations, humanitarian organizations, had been bringing food into this very isolated region and medical supplies. And we were going along the major road, and after about 2 or 3 weeks, somebody hit an anti-tank mine. Now, the anti-tank mine had been there all along. And somehow the trucks had missed it for a couple of weeks. And then one of the trucks hit it. This is the sort of thing that happens in a war zone. And you accept the risk or else you simply don't go there.
Is the part of the road that's been cleared clearly marked?
Yes, but there was even a problem at the Bagram airfield. This is the airfield that was first secured by American and British forces, and the road from Bagram into Kabul was supposedly cleared, and I went through that road once when I arrived in Kabul, and about a week later when I left, the signs had been changed around because what had been cleared apparently was not completely clear, and they had also had an incident. And that's the problem with landmines. And don't forget, landmines will move around. Soil erosion, snow, melting waters, etc., they will move mines around, and therefore you can say, oh, yes, this place was clear. And in the meantime, it's rained. And the next time you go through, well, a mine has found its way there because it's simply come down the hillside.
Have you had any frightening close calls with landmines?
Over the years, a couple of occasions where mines have exploded near to where I was at the time. But I've also been shot at and bombed, so
right.
everything is relative. I've been taken prisoner, I've been taken hostage, I've been, it's a relative question.
Why do you keep doing it? I mean, you've been at this for a long time. How many years?
Over 20.
So, you're constantly putting yourself in jeopardy, plus you're seeing some of the best, but also a lot of the worst aspects of humanity. You know, the way people wage war and kill each other. This is what you're immersed in all the time. So, what keeps you going back for more?
Well, what keeps me going, of course, is the best of humanity that I see. I have worked with Afghan surgeons. I've worked with Somali surgeons. I've worked with surgeons in the Congo and elsewhere. They haven't received a salary in a year or 2 years. Their families are there. Their families are in danger. I mean, I have a Canadian passport. I can get up and go away. My monthly salary is put into my bank account. I don't even have to worry about it or think about it. They are there. They don't have a bank account in Geneva. They don't have a Canadian passport. They're still taking care of their people. They don't get paid. And yet they don't run away. I mean, very courageous men and women. And it is my honor to know them, to know that they are my colleagues, to have worked with them, to try to support them so that they continue to work, to serve the health needs of their people, even in catastrophic situations. It is their example that keeps me going.
My guest is Dr. Chris Yanu, head surgeon with the International Committee of the Red Cross. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Chris Yanu, and he's the head surgeon for the International Committee of the Red Cross. He's been around the world performing surgery. He's been just in the past couple of years to Sri Lanka, Macedonia, the Congo, Somalia, Sierra Leone, and Uganda. From about mid-November through the end of 2001, he was in Afghanistan. Often both sides in a conflict recognize the value of the Red Cross and the difficult work that the Red Cross is trying to do, but sometimes human rights and medical groups become targets. What was traveling through Afghanistan like? Did you feel like, as a representative of the Red Cross, that you were respected as you were traveling through the country, or that you were sometimes the target?
In Afghanistan, the Red Cross is well known, and our colleagues of the Afghan Red Crescent are well known. They're present in the community in all of the provinces. ICRC has been present for over 20 years. We have a half dozen prosthetic centers around the country, artificial limbs. I mean, I remember once, several years ago, arriving in the north, in Kunduz, where no foreigner had been for 5 or 6 years. And we arrived in our car, and one fellow came tearing across the road, carrying his Kalashnikov. We froze. He came up to us, broke into a large smile, a grin, pulled up his pant leg, and knocked on his artificial limb, saying, RCRC, RCRC. and this was his prosthesis. And then he said, what do you need? What do you want? I can show you where to stay and where to eat and where to this and where to that and so forth and so forth, quite simply because the ICRC had provided him with an artificial limb, which allowed him to work, which in this case was to continue to fight. But he could have just as easily been a peasant, but he was able to run and walk with his artificial limb. And there are thousands of people like this all over Afghanistan. So we are known, and Afghanistan is not a problem. However, just last year, in April of 2001, we had 2 expatriate and 4 Congolese colleagues who were killed, assassinated, in the Congolese town of Bunia, near the border with Uganda. In many conflicts today, we can really talk about destructured conflicts. And many of the belligerents do not follow a chain of command, a real hierarchy. Many of them are local warlords. Some of them are simply mafia, local mafia, bandits.
So there's no accountability.
There's no accountability. And they maybe simply no don't education think of what either. The Red Cross can do for them or their people, because
right.
they don't care.
Right.
And this is where real danger occurs, and where we can become targets. Also, even where there is a chain of command, sometimes you become a target because people do not want embarrassing witnesses to be around, and they prefer to have all foreigners leave, whether it's Red Cross or UN or anybody else. So that also is a consideration in some contexts.
You have treated many victims of religious wars, and I'm sure you have treated many people who are very religious themselves and for whom religion becomes particularly important when they are facing death. Are you religious yourself? And I wonder, you must have thought a lot about religion, seeing it up close like that and seeing the best and worst of it as you have.
I am a practicing atheist.
They say there's no atheist in a foxhole. I guess you're proof that that's not true.
Mm. Yes.
And has what you've seen from religious wars upheld your atheism?
Well, it's what I've seen from any war, religious or otherwise, has upheld my atheism.
Care to expand on that?
When you see what human beings are capable of doing to each other, in the name of noble causes, et cetera, et cetera. And people talk of good and evil, and people were talking of good and evil long before President Bush. In war, you very, very quickly learn that the world is divided not amongst the good and the bad, but amongst the bad and the worse. That even good people in war do bad things. War obliges them to do evil things. The good person cannot stay good in war. It is the intrinsic nature of war that means that even the good person with good intentions must do things that are evil. And that is why I've seen that for me the world is divided, as I say, between the bad and the worse, not between the good and the bad.
Well, do you ever worry you're going to be infected by that, even though you're there as a doctor doing good, you're not there as a combatant, but still?
Have I always done things the right way? Have I not created dependencies in certain situations and people would have been better off without me being there? Those are questions that I continuously ask myself. I always ask myself those sort of questions.
We've been lucky to have you as a guest on Fresh Air several times over the years. And it's kind of traditional for me to end our interviews by me asking you if you've stopped smoking. And I ask that not in any judgmental way, but just out of curiosity, since you're living in these life and death situations all the time. And so perhaps the risks of smoking don't really seem all that risky when you're surrounded by landmines and bombs and people who want to take you hostage and so forth. So, but I'll ask, you're still smoking?
Well, no, I still smoke my Gitane cigarettes. I enjoy them. I enjoy them especially with a good shot of malt whiskey. And the pleasure of pleasurable company at the same time. That altogether goes very well.
And can you enjoy a good smoke with the people of the different countries that you go to? Do most countries smoke cigarettes without all the health
with all of the
questions that Americans...
The health questions and, may I add, the puritanical questions as well. Yes, of course you can. I say puritanical because I've just come back down from Canada, Ottawa and Toronto, where in Ottawa you can drink yourself silly, but you cannot have a cigarette with the drink in the bar. And it's very much of a puritanical. It has nothing to do with health at this point. It's a fundamentalist sort of sign. But in many countries, yes, you can sit down and have a smoke with somebody, and offering a cigarette is considered to be a great sign of generosity and hospitality.
Well, Dr. Yanu, I wish you continued health and good luck on your travels around the world. And thank you for doing the work that you do.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Dr. Chris Yanu is the head surgeon with the International Committee of the Red Cross. Coming up, Father Chris Keenan, a chaplain with the New York Fire Department, where he succeeded Father Michael Judge, who was killed on September 11th. This is Fresh Air. Father Chris Keenan recently became a Catholic chaplain for the Fire Department of New York. He succeeded Father Michael Judge, who was killed at the World Trade Center on September 11th, where he was praying over dying firefighters. Father Keenan has also worked with people in AIDS hospices and homeless shelters. He's the founding director of social outreach and volunteers at the Church of St. Francis of Assisi in Manhattan. Father Judge was a mentor and friend to Father Keenan. Earlier this month at Hamline University, the Immortal Chaplains Foundation honored Michael Judge with an award for risking his life to protect people of a different faith or ethnic origin. Father Keenan and Judge's two sisters accepted on Judge's behalf. Father Judge has become a symbol of dedication and self-sacrifice. Father Keenan says a now famous photo of Judge's body only adds to his iconic stature.
It's the only picture that we have of a body that came out that was intact, viewable, and identifiable. And there's two firefighters, police officers, a civilian, and someone from the Office of Emergency Management. In that picture of Michael being brought out of the rubble, he's the only one whom I know had an open coffin, and he was the first funeral, and it was broadcast internationally. And so in so many ways, he became an icon of the first context that we had of mourning. It was a picture that that just captured the reality of what happened September 11th.
You've taken Father Michael Judge's place as a chaplain with the New York Fire Department. You actually met him 28 years ago, and I've read that it was Michael Judge who convinced you to become a priest yourself.
It was 38 years ago, Terry.
38 years ago.
Yes. I met him when I was 21, 38 years ago, and he himself had been a newly ordained priest at the time. I was working in a job at the time, loading and unloading trucks. I was going to school nights, and happened to have met him in the process of my early life. As I was looking at the possibility of the Franciscans, which in many ways he and a group of young Franciscans had inspired me to, I said to him, for example, Michael, you know, in no way could I ever possibly contain the studies. I am just in no way a student. And in so many ways, I felt that I was so far from the reality and yet was so inspired by the wonderful witness of his life and the other young Franciscans that I had met. And he just simply said to me, Chris, if I could do it, you could do it. And he was at the first homily that I ever delivered at a mass. And afterwards, I went to my room, and up on my door was this incredible big sign, and it had, Chris, you know, a great job, wonderful message, right to the point, inspiring to the people, faithful to the gospel. He had this incredible ability to take a moment and to reflect back to you your goodness and just, you know, calling you forth to be the best of who you could be.
What's the protocol about when a chaplain is sent to a fire?
Of the seven chaplains currently in the New York Fire Department, if there was a 3 or 4 alarm fire, that notice would go out to some of the chaplains, and they would try to have at least one at the scene of that fire. It's not as if you respond to every fire. However, you know, the ones that are more serious, you know, you would respond to. For example, on my beeper this morning, it states that last night in the city there were 1,119 fires, that there were 2,973 emergency service responses, and 392 times that an engine in the fire department accompanied the emergency service at a call.
Wow. It's really a lot.
Yes, and the more serious ones, then we would be contacted to respond to and to be with them there.
When you work with firefighters, you often ask yourself what leads a person to take on such a high-risk, self-sacrificing kind of job. Not everybody's capable of doing that. What kind of person can do that?
Well, it's a very unusual type of person. It really is an incredible sense of mission among them. And what's really fascinating that I have found within the reality of the fire department is learning some things I never knew before. For example, the firefighters every day go out on the rig to the supermarket and they buy the food for the day that they pay for and that they cook themselves. And they also sleep in open dormitories. Everything that they do on the rig must be done really clearly as a team, and their lives really depend upon one another. It's an incredible gift to be present with them.
I want to get back to a couple of things about Father Michael Judge. You've worked with the homeless for years and continue to do that even as you serve as a chaplain with the fire department. I know Father Michael Judge worked with the homeless as well. Did you work with him at that time?
Terry, a lot of what we did was together as brothers out of the fraternity of the Church of St. Francis. However, I worked more in the shelters. Michael worked more directly with people on the street. And I remember one time we were coming one evening from a meeting, and we were talking with people that we mutually knew in the street, and Michael had, he would give out dollar bills, for example, or whatever to the folk. And I happened to say to him as we were walking on, well, you know, how was your day and where were you earlier? And it emerged that he'd been at a meeting of the White House that morning for a breakfast for religious leaders that was called by the president and the first lady. And so here we are, you know, at night with him, with the poor in the streets, and in the morning he'd been, having breakfast with the president and the first lady. He'd been present, in so many different ways, not just to the firefighters, but to the leadership of the city of New York. He had an incredible presence and a great correspondence with people. For example, if he had done your wedding, you and your husband would have a card or a call from him on every anniversary of your wedding. Or if someone had died in the family, he would, particularly at the holidays, be in touch with you, and on the anniversary of that person every year you would have a remembrance. He had an incredible way of touching and being in touch with people and of never forgetting that they were a part of his life.
Father Chris Keenan succeeded the late Father Michael Judge as a chaplain of the New York Fire Department. Earlier this month, Father Keenan and Judge's two sisters accepted the Immortal Chaplain's Prize for Humanity on behalf of Father Judge. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Founding Brothers, The Revolutionary Generation by Joseph J. Ellis. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Everybody knows you've been stepping on my toes, and I'm getting pretty tired of it.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with Waylon Jennings. The country music outlaw died this week at the age of 64. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Said I was the only man in this whole world. Now you better do some thinking, then you'll find you got the only